Welcome to the New Books Network.
What does it mean for the Gospel of Mark to portray Jesus as Son of God? Apparently, far more than what past scholarship has recognized. James Newman argues that Mark presents Jesus' life from beginning to end as the actualization of Psalm 2, a coronation hymn describing the Davidic king as God's son. Join us as we speak with James Newman about his recent book, The Gospel of the Son of God. You're listening to New Books in Biblical Studies, a channel of the New Books Network, and I'm your host, Michael Morales. James Newman teaches New Testament as a postdoctoral fellow at Princeton Theological Seminary. Jim, welcome to New Books in Biblical Studies.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about yourself and how you became interested in Mark's narrative Christology.
Sure. My name is Jim Newman, and I teach New Testament at Princeton Theological Seminary. And besides that, I'm also very active in my local church, Stonehill Church of Princeton, where I am a frequent Sunday school teacher, small group leader, and more. Before coming to Princeton, I studied at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary, and before that, a small school that probably not too many people have heard of called Mississippi College. And it was really there in my undergrad days at Mississippi College that my interest in Mark's narrative Christology began, you could say. It was while I was there that a professor first showed me the inclusio that I write so much about in the book between Jesus' baptism in Mark 1, 10 and 11, and his crucifixion in 1538 and 39. There in the baptism, of course, we have the heavens torn apart, followed by the voice from heaven saying, "You are my beloved son in whom I am well pleased." In 1538 and 39 at the crucifixion, we have the temple veil torn apart using the same verb as in 1:10, followed by a Roman centurion saying, "Truly this man was the Son of God." So you have those parallels there that bookend the entire gospel. And one of the things that did for me was to highlight the fact that Mark has real large-scale narrative aims. And furthermore, I think as a young person, as an undergrad, that one of the things that fascinated me so much was that showed me that one of the ways that the gospel writers communicate their theology and chiefly their Christology, since the gospels are about Jesus Christ, is through the vehicle of narrative itself, that they can, that part of what they want to say to us and show us about who Jesus is communicated through a literary vehicle, if you will, through the vehicle of narrative. And if you can have something like an inclusio that spans all the way from the beginning, the first time we see Jesus, to the last time we see Jesus in Mark's gospel, then that also says that what Mark is doing on a literary level is large scale. It encompasses the entire narrative, and it's important, therefore, to read the Gospels as a narrative whole. Some past scholarship has tended to atomize, but take an atomistic look at the Gospels and look at this pericope and this and that pericope, but it's important to look at the Gospels as a unified whole. So for instance, one of the things that I'm doing in my book is asking the question, what is Mark doing by pairing God's declaration, "You are my son, you are my beloved son," which echoes the words of Psalm 2, alongside a Roman centurion's proclamation, "Truly this man was the Son of God." It's really interesting that we have these two statements juxtaposed, so to speak, through Mark's literary device. But what is he doing? Why is Mark juxtaposing a statement of God in the beginning of the gospel with the statement of a Roman centurion at the end? What's he trying to show us through that? What's he trying to tell us about Jesus through this literary device? So that's a little bit of how I got interested in Mark's narrative Christology, and a little bit of what my current interest in this book has been. And Yeah, I should maybe just add that when I was an undergrad, I was also, in addition to being a biblical studies major, I was an English lit major. So reading the Gospels as stories was something that I think came naturally to me.
For starters, would you explain for us the context and significance or the story of Psalm 2?
Sure. The story of Psalm 2, as I put it in my book, is a fascinating one. I find it fascinating, at least. So what we know about Psalm 2 is that it was originally a coronation hymn for the Davidic king. Most all scholars who have studied the psalm agree on that. And then in the Second Temple period, what seems to have happened is that it was universally read in a messianic sense. That is to say, as a text that was referring to God's eschatological enthronement or installation of his Messiah. And then in the New Testament and in all Christian literature afterward, the psalm becomes applied to Jesus, and especially. One of the really interesting things is especially to the subjects of his passion, death, and resurrection. And so they're reading it as a messianic psalm. They're applying it to Jesus, but they're especially reading it in conjunction with his passion, death, and resurrection. But there's also a story, if you will, told within Psalm 2. And the psalm itself is interesting in that, psalms are not narratives, but there is a sort of narrative that we see within Psalm 2 in that it follows a clear progression that begins with the scene of worldwide rebellion by the rulers and powers that be against God and his anointed. And then the psalm presents God's enthronement of his king, whom he calls his son in the central verse of the psalm and Psalm 2:7, presents God's enthronement of his king, whom he calls his son, as his vice-regent in answer to this problem. So God's answer to the problem of worldwide rebellion is to install or enthrone his anointed son, the king. And so then the psalm concludes with all of the nations, in effect, bowing to Yahweh, acknowledging Yahweh through his son, wherein peace and cosmic order is restored. And so God's answer to the problem of history, you could say, is to enthrone his anointed son, as king. And through that, the nations come to acknowledge him in the end. So one final thing then about the psalm beyond all that that's really interesting to note is that Psalm 2 provides the only linkage of the terms son and Mashiach or Messiah in the Jewish scriptures. It's the only text that identifies God's son and God's Messiah as the same person is Psalm 2. And what we find in subsequent Jewish literature in the Second Temple period and beyond is that Psalm 2 also seems to stand behind every Jewish text afterward that refers to the Messiah as God's son. So we can actually probably say that Psalm 2 is the source of the idea that the Messiah is God's son. And so then in the New Testament, one further note. One thing I learned actually in the course of this project as I started cataloging all the allusions to Psalm 2 in the New Testament is that Psalm 2 actually appears to be alluded to more than any other psalm in the New Testament. So Psalm 110 wins the award if you just want to talk about quotations. Psalm 110 is quoted more than any other psalm. But if you want to talk about allusions, Psalm 2 is alluded to more than any other psalm in the New Testament.
Jim, would you rehearse for us the role of Psalm 2 in Mark's presentation of Christ's transfiguration?
Yes, so that's a really interesting one. A lot of scholars have talked about Psalm 2 in conjunction with Jesus' baptism. It's talked about maybe a little bit less in conjunction with the transfiguration, although it is acknowledged to be a part of the transfiguration seen by virtually all scholars. To begin with, the Transfiguration in Mark 9, 2 through 8 is usually considered to be the second of the three sort of climactic revelatory moments in Mark's gospel, the other two being Jesus' baptism in the beginning and his crucifixion at the end. And so it's significant that we hear the words of Psalm 2:7 echoed at both of the first two of these climactic revelatory moments, first at Jesus' baptism in 1:11, and then again at the close of the transfiguration scene in Mark 9:7. And so, if nothing else, that kind of repetition of Psalm 2:7 in key moments in the gospel highlights the importance that it must have for Mark's portrait of Jesus. That said, I think the importance of Psalm 2 in Jesus' transfiguration is often overlooked because it gets overshadowed by the series of allusions that we find to Exodus 24 and the appearance of Moses and Elijah and connections to Mount Sinai and so much else. There are so many things going on at once in the transfiguration scene that I think Psalm 2 is almost forgotten about sometimes because commentators have already talked about it in Jesus' baptism, so they don't talk about it again when they get to the transfiguration. The citation or near citation that we find of Psalm 2:7 and Mark 9:7 is really the climax of the whole transfiguration scene in Mark. And so, on the one hand, it's like I said, it's a repetition of the voice at Jesus' baptism, reiterating what was already said there. But on the other hand, it takes on a new meaning. In the Transfiguration scene, the Transfiguration scene as a whole is really filled with a lot of enthronement motifs, for lack of a better term. So when we see Psalm 2:7, an enthronement psalm echoed at the very climax of this scene that is otherwise filled with enthronement motifs, it makes sense to think that part of what Mark is doing here is to give us a glimpse. A preview, if you will, of Jesus' eschatological enthronement as the Messiah, Son of God. So that's kind of how I read Psalm 2 in the Transfiguration scene.
How does Psalm 2 relate to the culminating moment of Mark's gospel?
This is really kind of the million-dollar question for my book, as far as my book is concerned. In a way, the answer to this question is the whole reason for writing this book in the first place. So, when Jesus is crucified in Mark's gospel, we have a centurion. The centurion who's overseeing his execution rather shockingly declares, "Truly, this man was the Son of God," in Mark 15:39. That's shocking on multiple levels. For one thing, it's shocking on a historical level because it's historically speaking bizarre that a Roman centurion would say such a thing. A Roman centurion as an officer in the Roman military. Would have been expected to acknowledge Caesar as Son of God. Augustus Caesar actually took Son of God as his own name, and Caesars after him tended to claim some form of Son of God, some variation on those words as part of their name as well. A Roman centurion would have been expected probably to confess that and to call someone else Son of God was potentially treasonous. So this is a shocking thing to hear a Roman centurion say, period, and even more so to say about a Jewish peasant who is dying the most shameful death that Rome had to offer, dying as a criminal against the Roman Empire. So historically, it's shocking. And for that reason, you've had scholars over the years doubt whether the centurion can even be sincere as he says this. Maybe he doesn't actually mean it. Maybe he's being sarcastic. Maybe he's mocking Jesus as he calls him Son of God. The problem is multiple studies at this point. One of the best in this regard, I think, is Brian Gammell's book on Mark 15:39. But there have been several studies besides Gammell's to highlight the fact that Mark really does seem to present the centurion's confession as a sincere one. Mark actually gives us a lot of narrative cues that suggest he's trying to hint to us that we should take the centurion's confession seriously, that centurion really means what he says. So we have to deal with it somehow or another, as shocking as it is, as unlikely as it seems. The second reason, though, why this is shocking is actually the narrative one. As I said earlier, on a literary level, Mark presents the crucifixion as the third and final of three climactic revelatory moments in his gospel, the first two being the baptism and the transfiguration, as we just talked about. So now, there are all kinds of narrative parallels between these three scenes, between the baptism, transfiguration, and crucifixion, including the fact that Jesus is called God's son on all three occasions. But in the first two instances, at the baptism and in the transfiguration, the words, "You are my son," are coming from Psalm 2:7. So there's a way in which the narrative, Mark's narrative, kind of conditions us to expect, sets us up to expect another echo of Psalm 2 at Jesus' crucifixion. But the problem then, the problem with that is that, of course, there's no way plausibly that a Roman centurion is quoting or alluding to Psalm 2:7, nor is there any way that Mark's intended audience would have thought so. That would have been an unbelievable scenario to the people that Mark was likely writing to. There is another possibility to consider, though, and this is the direction I go with it in my book, and that is, what if the centurion's words are actually meant to signify an ironic, unintended fulfillment of Psalm 2, specifically Psalm 2, 7 and 8, where the son inherits the nations. So, after all, a representative of the world's leading empire, this is what we see in Mark 15:39, a representative of the world's leading empire is effectively here bowing the knee to Jesus as God's true son. And that has a way of fulfilling that vision of Psalm 2 really nicely, where God and declares to the king, "You are my son." And in the very next verse, we have the son inheriting the nations. So, on this interpretation, Jesus begins to inherit the worship of the nations precisely through this representative of the leading empire of the world bowing the knee to him as the true son of God. But the kicker with all of that is that Mark is signaling to us then that Jesus' crucifixion, of all things, is the very moment when he dies on the cross, in fact, is the moment of his victory when he inherits the nations. So the cross, as it turns out, was no defeat, as Mark portrays it, but rather the moment of the son's enthronement and his triumph, by which he inherits the world. And so that's how Psalm 2 relates to the culminating moment of Mark's gospel.
What else are you working on? Any forthcoming publications you can tell us about?
So right now I have just got word the other day that a paper I wrote will be I'll be presenting it at SBL at the at a session on Mark's Passion Narrative. That's a paper called Mark, Elijah, and the Day of the Lord, which explores another connection that we find between Jesus' baptism, transfiguration, and crucifixion, which is that Elijah is either somehow present or mentioned on all three occasions. And so this was something I didn't have a chance to take up in my book, but something that I noticed and wanted to follow up on. And so I've written a piece about that and what I think the purpose of those. What I think Mark's theological purpose in mentioning Elijah in all three places might be. So I hope to publish that. I'll be presenting it at SBL and then, one way or another, probably publishing it afterward. In addition to that, I have been teaching on Romans this semester, and that's given me occasion to think about Paul's letters again, rather than the Gospels, more than and in a little bit more depth than I've gotten to do in a while. And so out of that has come an article that I am just beginning to work on Romans 9:5, where I think that Paul may actually be alluding to the divine name as it appears in the Septuagint of Exodus chapter 3, and applying it directly to Jesus. Beyond that, I am beginning some preliminary research for what will hopefully be my second book, which explores what I take to be John's use of the synoptics. And so this represents sort of a changing tide in New Testament scholarship where, for ages, scholars were largely convinced there was a large consensus that John was completely independent of the Synoptics and did not know the Synoptics. In recent years, a lot of scholars have been changing their minds about that and thinking that John probably does know one or more, maybe even all, of the Synoptics. I'm convinced that that is probably the case, but what I really want to do is explore the idea that I think John not only knows the Synoptics, but is counting on his readers knowing the Synoptics as well. And one of the things that he's actually trying to do in his gospel is give intentional theological commentary on the Synoptic tradition. And so that's a little bit of where I plan to go in my hopeful second book.
Jim, thank you for sharing your work on Mark's gospel. It's been a delight having you on the show.
Well, thank you. It's been a delight to be here. Thanks for the opportunity.
Friends, thank you for listening to New Books and Biblical Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. Until next time, goodbye.